Welcome to the Horror Writers Podcast. Join Jay Thorne and Richard Brown as they discuss writing and publishing horror using strategies that work for all genres.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Horror Writers Podcast. This is episode number 18. I'm your host, Jay Thorne, along with co-host, the best host, Richard Brown. Do it, Richard!
No.
Every week, Richard says, hello, Richard.
Every week, you have the same intro, and it's just getting boring.
Well, that's why I just changed it up.
That was changing it up? What was I supposed to do?
Well, what you're doing right now, that's different.
Just improvising?
I guess, instead of making the same stupid joke.
Oh, say hello, Richard, and then I go, hello, Richard, and then you go, oh, we love that joke. Like, it's gotten old now.
You're old, Richard.
You're older than me, aren't you?
Well, I'm gonna ignore Richard and his whiny little pissy mood he's in and bring on our guest for today. Yeah, Richard's a night owl. We have a special guest with us on this episode, a guy I've been working with for a year, and yet this is the first time we've sort of met or spoken, which is kind of crazy. But we'd like to welcome David Moody to the show.
Well, it's good to be here.
So, David, maybe you could give our viewers just a little bit of info about who you are and what you do.
Okay, yeah, sure. I've been around a long time, unfortunately. I didn't realize how long it was until I came to work on a newer version of my first novel and realized it had been 20 years since I wrote it. Scary as hell. My books are all older than my kids. I've been writing for about 20 years, as I say. I guess that people often talk about me as kind of one of the first self-publishers. Because way back in the day, after I'd written my first book and it had disappeared without trace, I was thinking it was going to go on to do massive things, and it didn't. So after that, I'd written my second book, Autumn, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't want to go down the same route of submitting it to agents and editors and just going round and round in circles. So I started giving it away. Started giving away PDFs and Word documents, and this was way, way before Kindle and iBooks. This was back when nobody really was giving away free books. And it kind of took off. I think I just hit the genre at the right time. It was a zombie novel, and it was just when zombies were becoming popular, not as cliched and passe as they've become now. So yeah, it did really well. It got a few hundred thousand downloads pretty quickly, and I started writing a few sequels and started charging for them. On the back of it, set up my own little publishing company, Infected Books. And then things went a little bit crazy because I kept putting these books out. Film rights to Autumn got picked up, and then another book I'd written called Hater, the film rights got picked up by Guillermo del Toro and Mark Johnson, who's the producer of Breaking Bad most recently. And on the back of all of that, my books got picked up by Thomas Dunn Books in America and then sold on around the world. So it kind of exploded from nowhere. It's been a bit strange, a bit of a wild ride, but it's all cool.
Would it be safe to call you the Ozzy Osbourne of zombie self-publishing?
Is that a reference to the fact that me and Ozzy are both from Birmingham? Have we got the same accent?
I didn't know that, but I was thinking more like the godfather of zombie self-publishing, the way Ozzy's the godfather of heavy metal.
Well, but being called Ozzy Osbourne is a compliment and an insult in the same breath, isn't it?
Can you sing a little Ozzy for us?
No.
No?
No, just no. But yeah, he's a fellow Brummie. He's from Birmingham too. This is... Where I am now, this is the home of metal, the home of Black Sabbath.
That's a really interesting correlation between sort of what you write and the roots of Black Sabbath. I kind of have a sense, but what's Birmingham like, or what was it like growing up in Birmingham?
It's quite an unusual city. It's the UK's second city, so it's pretty big, but nowhere near on the scale of London or anywhere pretty much outside the country. There's about 1 million people here. It's got a lot of industrial history. It's where there was a lot of car making previously, and a lot of really there's an area just outside Birmingham called the Black Country, and it's called the Black Country because it was permanently dirty because of all the smoke from factories and chimneys and things. So it's got a kind of, yeah, not a particularly creative heritage, but a real roots, you know, nuts and bolts, down to earth kind of heritage. All that said, Tolkien came from here, and there's a lot of inspirations for the Lord of the Rings trilogy around here. We've actually got the two towers that he used, that inspired him to write the two towers. They actually exist, and they're here in Birmingham. It's a cool place. It's undergone a lot of a resurgence over the last few years. And now it's all bright and shiny and new and pretty cool place to be, actually.
It doesn't surprise me. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I can remember growing up there and hearing Birmingham as sort of like a sister city, because Pittsburgh was synonymous with the steel industry. And I can remember going to my grandparents' house, and my grandfather had an above-ground pool, and he had to sweep it every day because the black soot from all the factories would build up on the bottom of the pool. And the hills above the river were always dead and black from the industry. So I can relate.
Very, very Birmingham-esque.
And so you've stayed there your whole life, pretty much?
Pretty much, yeah. Moved out of the city, but lived just quite close to it for about 10 years or so. But yeah, we moved back a few years ago. Can't seem to get rid of it. And when you have kids, you're kind of tied down to an area more. So I've got a large family, so we kind of stay where the children need to be. Until they're old enough so that we can escape and go away on our own.
Where's that going to be? Have you thought about it?
Who knows? Who knows?
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. You'd feel right at home, trust me. David, I first came across your work probably in, I don't know, 2006 or 2007, and I think I was one of those people who sort of downloaded, I think it was Hader, might have been Hader, and sort of discovered that, like you said, long before self-publishing was even called self-publishing. So I'm curious kind of like how you came up with the idea to get it out there, or if you even remember like being that aware of it, or if it just something that sort of happened.
Yeah, I do actually remember a specific conversation, because as I said, once I'd put my first book out and it had been met with almost universal silence, you know, no sales at all, because they were really pre-internet days. So the only way that you could tell people about your book was by actually going into bookstores and saying, please order this in and I'll come and sign it for you. I think the publisher printed 500 copies, and I've still got about 200 of them sitting in my garage at the moment. So yeah, as I said earlier, I really got to the point where I'd got this second book written, and I thought, what do I do with it? And it just occurred to me that the most important thing is not making money from it. The most important thing is getting an audience. And I thought, take money out of the equation, why don't I just start giving it to people? And so that's what I did, and that's where all the downloads came from, as I said. And I do remember having a specific conversation with my wife and saying, I need to get online, because this was back in the days when you had to, you know, it was a big effort for people to get online, and it was all dial-up connections and all that kind of rubbish. But yeah, I just thought, we'll just put it online and see what happens, and people did start to download it. And then really I kind of got caught upon the wave of the beginnings of self-publishing as we know it now. I didn't used to call it self-publishing because that had a real stigma attached to it, and I think it still does to an extent. I always called it independent publishing. And I often talk about my company Infected Books because I try and, it sounds really corporate and naff, but I try and hide behind a brand because I think that it gives you more credibility to have a logo, to have a little, you know, a little logo on the spine of your books, and to make it look like you've got somebody working for you here rather than a lowly author just saying, here, please read my book. I've printed it myself especially for you. So yeah, it was a kind of snowball effect. By the time that Autumn was really well established, I had it as an online serialization and then as a free download. And by the time people had really got into that, the first paid ebook sites were starting to crop up on the internet. So I wrote the first sequel, which is called The City, and just made that available via these sites, only for a couple of dollars, a couple of pounds at a time. Not knowing what the impact would be, and I was just amazed when people started buying it, and I thought, well, people are going to pay for this stuff. And so I just kept doing that. I put out a third book in a series called Purification. Same thing happened again. I remember maybe 2 or 3 downloads a day, something like that. It suddenly turned into, the day that that book was launched, 300 downloads on a day. And that, for me, was just astronomical at the time. And it really occurred to me that I could do something with this. Mm-hmm. And I then started investigating print on demand and was able to get paperback versions of the books produced. And then Amazon came along and they were integrated with Lightning Source, the printer that I used and still do use. So suddenly I found I'd got worldwide distribution online, which was just an unexpected bonus that really upped the ante for me. It all really went from there. And that, you know, as ebooks became more and more established, the whole thing kind of grew. I was involved with Moby Parkit, which mutated eventually into Amazon Kindle when Amazon bought the company. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft had their .lit files, Microsoft Reader, that kind of thing. There was Palm Pilot, there were Rocket eBooks. I was just basically finding every single format that I could, converting the book and just getting it out in as many different avenues as I could, as many different channels, just to see what would stick and where people would buy. And yeah, it worked. But as I say, no great plan to it. It was very much just caught up on the wave. We just hit the market at the right time, I think.
So at some point, you started indie publishing. At some point, you got traditional publishers interested?
Yeah, that's right. That was after the film rights to Hater had been bought up. Suddenly, because I'd got names attached to the books, I'd got publishers asking about them as well, which was great because it's been really cool to see both sides of the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that the money's better with traditional, well, it was for a time. But I prefer the freedom and flexibility of independent publishing. And that's what I've gone back to. If a publisher came along and said, we'll offer you XXX dollars for your next book, then of course I'm going to look at it. But generally, I really like being back in control and not having to wait a year and a half between finishing the book and publishing it. You know, finish it one day, get it out the next day. That's the kind of way that I want to move. I want real control over. I hate talking about it as product, but you have to think about it that way. I'm a control freak, I guess is what I'm saying, in a very long, rambling way.
So you sold the film rights before the book was even picked up?
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I've never found out how it happened, and I don't want to think about it too much because the chances of it were just insane. But I remember sitting at my computer one night, and Hater had been out for maybe 2 or 3 months. It sold pretty well for a self-published book back in the day. And an email came in from a guy in Los Angeles, and I thought, this is somebody having a laugh. This is somebody winding me up. And so I went through all my friends and family and said, okay, who is it? Yeah, it's very funny, but that's enough now. And I got in touch with the guy, and it turned out to be pretty genuine. And then things got very surreal, and I was like having phone calls with Mark Johnson, who was producing one of the Narnia films at the time. And so he was on set in New Zealand, and I'd got his assistant in his office in Los Angeles, and I was at home in Birmingham trying to get the kids to bed and stop the dog from barking. It's just all very surreal.
What was your wife saying at the time? You know, you're selling, or you're giving away 2 copies a day, and you're trying to take care of the family. Was she like, yeah, go for it, David? Or was she more like, hey, we got these bills to pay. What are you doing?
It's really difficult. I was working full time as well. You know, I was for my sins, I was a bank manager, which sounds really terrible, but not the kind of corporate people shafting banks that we have these days. I was working in a processing center, so we had some money coming in, but it was just a question of getting to the point where the books would be enough to replace the salary from the bank, and it took a long time. It was. Yeah, 5-6 years, I think. And it wasn't until all the deals were in place, the film deal, and I'd had some advances on the books from Thomas Dunn Books in New York that I could actually do it. And that fortunately coincided with her wanting to go back to work after finishing her studies. So it all worked out pretty nicely for us. She's always been really supportive. But it's difficult, I think, for people who aren't. Like I say, I'm a control freak, so I pull all the strings as far as books are concerned, and it's quite difficult for a partner in that kind of situation to say, yeah, okay, get on with it, when there's a mortgage at stake and there's food that needs putting on the table and that kind of thing. you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I do. Do your kids read your stuff?
They do, actually.
Yeah?
That's great. And they're always kind of surprised when they like it. I remember a couple of years ago, after finishing some exams, Megan, at the middle one of it, we've got five girls. It's bad news. We've got five girls. The middle one, Megan, she worked her way through the Hater trilogy through one summer after finishing her exams, as I said. And she kind of sheepishly came into my office after that and said, they're actually really good. They've actually unsettled me a little bit. And I thought, yeah, job done.
Well, there's sort of a natural... sort of a natural thing with your kids where, you know, they hit a certain age and you're no longer cool, and they kind of want to put a lot of distance between you. So the fact that your daughter at that age recognized that she enjoyed it says a lot.
Do you know, it makes me feel really proud, because I think of how I was towards my dad. He's a great guy, but I didn't go around telling my friends, hey, my dad's a maintenance manager at a battery factory. That's so cool. But please don't take this as me stalking my kids on social media, but I happened to see one of the girls posted a picture on Instagram of the shelf behind me here in my office with just loads of books on it. I've got rid of most of them there, but it was rammed with books. And the caption she put on Instagram was, my dad has the coolest job. And I thought, yeah, that's okay.
That's fantastic.
Are all those books on that shelf, those are all yours?
What, behind here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
All different versions from around the world. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
That's way larger than my bookshelf. So I know a lot of, there's a lot of books that get sold, the movie rights get sold, and then they don't ever get made. What mm-hmm. do you think the odds are that Hater gets made into a movie? Anything? Is it moving forward?
It's a really interesting question. At the moment, it's kind of not moving forward. Everything got really exciting and moved really quickly for a couple of years. And it got to the point where it was literally, you know, just they were really about to go into production and the budgets were finalized and it was all set up at Universal. But the script wasn't right. They had J.A. Bayona, who was going to direct it, the guy that made The Orphanage and The Impossible. You know, brilliant director, and it was all poised. Everything was announced. We had the variety ads and that kind of thing, and then, yeah, it just didn't work out. It's such a really fickle business, mm-hmm. and it's difficult because as a writer, when you're working with companies of that size, you just have no influence whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So really all I could do was just sit back and watch. The other extreme was Autumn, when I sold the film rights to that at pretty much within weeks of Hater. And that was a really low-budget, independent Canadian film, which went into production straight away. And it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, many people hate it. But they made a great job of it. David Carradine, mm-hmm. in one of his final roles before he died, he was in it. And Dexter Fletcher, who was in Lock, Stock and films like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that got made. As far as Hater at the moment, the rights are up again, so we're negotiating right now. I've got interest from some other parties, and I'm hopeful that one way or another something will happen with it. It's not a zombie book as such, but it's got zombie-like themes. It's about us versus them, different types of humans against each other. And it just seems to me that every summer there's a film that has similar kind of themes. Like 2 years ago it was World War Z, then... Now, this year it was The Planet of the Apes. People want to see this kind of conflict, so I'm really hopeful that people will still be interested in a Hater film, that it'll happen.
Have you ever written any screenplays?
I've dabbled a little bit. I've written a few shorts. I haven't gone into production as yet, but yeah, one of the things I'm looking at is perhaps writing the Hater screenplay if the rights move to one of the parties that are interested at the moment. It's something I'd love to do. In fact, I always describe myself as a frustrated filmmaker, because it's what I wanted to do after leaving school. But way, way back when I left school, the early 90s, the chances of getting any kind of foothold in film without any experience were just, there was no way at all. You know, you didn't have video cameras like we do now. You didn't have editing software on computers. It was just, nowadays, I think you can pretty much self-publish a film, which is something that I'm going to be looking to do in the next few years. I know self-publish a film is kind of a contradiction, but that's what I'm looking to do. I'd love to get involved in it.
Jay's a failed musician, so that's why he writes books.
I've failed at a lot of things. In fact, I've failed at most things in my life. Richard, on the other hand, is perfect. He's never failed at anything.
I never screw up. Never.
Yeah, I kind of got that impression.
How's your approach to writing a screenplay different than writing a novel? I mean, I know it's still storytelling, but what's sort of a nuance between the two?
For me, it's very similar because I always do probably too much planning. I was at an event this weekend talking about planning with some other authors, and some authors describe themselves as kind of seat-of-the-pants writers, and they'll just sit down with an idea and just go for it. I don't know what you're like. Personally, I like to plan and plan and plan and revise and then go into a first draft and then throw that all out the window and do it again. But for me, there's a lot of planning. There's a lot of gestation with an idea before you commit pen to paper or whatever, fingers to keyboard, however you want to describe it. But I find the one thing that I always do is visualize the film, the book. I think of them almost as the same thing. It's a very visual process for me. Even though I can't draw, I can't do a bit of graphics or anything, so it's all completely in my head, but I know how I want things to look. So really, in terms of writing either a screenplay or a novel, it's not a huge difference for me. Same kind of process to get to the beginning point. I like the freedom of writing a screenplay because it's really point and click, isn't it? He does this, they do that, cut out all the descriptive words. Mm-hmm. But then the other side of that is I love also filling in the blanks. One of the shorts that I wrote called Isolation, which we didn't get filmed, I thought, I've got to do something with this story. So I wrote a novella, and it was just a huge amount of fun to go back to the original script and write it as a novel. It's just, yeah, I don't think there's a huge difference, not from my point of view anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. I hope this is okay, and I want you to be perfectly honest. But
okay,
you're the first one of the guys that I've talked to post-publication on the Black Fang Betrayal. Yeah. I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about what that was like for you.
That for me, that was... it was kind of liberating and terrifying at the same time. I knew that I was going to be pushed for time this year. I knew it wasn't going to be the easiest year, and I thought, is this something that I can do? And there were lots of things, I'll be completely honest, screaming inside me saying, you can't do it. It's not your field. It's nothing. And they were the kind of noises that made me want to do it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I've never collaborated in terms of writing. I've never written anything to the, I don't do gods and angels and demons and magic. It's just so not me. So to have to write something in that kind of genre, it really freaked me out to start with. But I absolutely loved it. It was just a huge blast to say, here's a story, here's the character, get on with it. It was great. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And you know, all credit to you, Jay, the way that it came together. I think you reminded me of a kind of a conductor. Mm. You know, everybody was playing their individual parts, but you could see the whole score. This sounds so cliched, I'm sorry, but genuinely that's how it felt. And I loved the way that it came together, and I love the reception that it's had. It seems to have done really well and caused a few ripples, which is great.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm so thrilled with the way it turned out, and I know that you weren't the only guy that was like, boy, this is not what I do. This is really kind of stretching me, and almost to the point of like, should I even do this? And I think it's really a testimony to guys like you and writers like you who fight through that and stick with it and don't play it safe and take a risk every now and then. And I think it paid off. And you know, the story you wrote was fantastic. I hope some of our listeners have read it and checked it out. And it was just a thrill. And I'm so glad you were part of it.
Yeah, it was. I'm also really glad to have been part of it. It was just a great experience. it was kind of, it was like a black cloud over my shoulder for a while after I said yes, thinking, no, I've got to do this, is it ever going to work out? And it was painful. It was like pulling teeth at times to actually write it and to try and plot it. But then once it was done, the relief and the pride at having written this little story, it's just, yeah, it's great. And I would recommend any writer in a similar position being asked to move outside their comfort zone, just go for it once in a while. It made me more confident about what I do generally. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, not trying to fall into cliche here, but it really did have a positive effect.
Yeah, I felt it. I mean, early on in our conversations, I kind of felt your reluctance. And yeah. And I could tell that it was, you know, it was going to be challenging for you just because of that. And so that it means all the more to me that you kind of stuck with it. But I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about your new book you have coming out soon called Strangers, because it's sort of a departure from some of your other stuff. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think I often describe myself as a people watcher, which makes me sound like some kind of pervert. I'm not. I'm just really interested in the way that
perverts are accepted here.
Say that again?
Said perverts are accepted here.
Oh, that's okay then. All right. I often describe myself as a pervert. I like watching the way that people interact with each other, or how they don't interact, or, you know, the way that people will put up defenses and this immediate distrust we have of anybody or anything that's a little bit different. And a lot of the books that I've written in the past kind of deal with that, but they often get heavy. Hater really had some quite weighty themes attached to it as the series progressed. So I wanted to write something that was very different and quite immediate, but still have those kinds of overtones. And I don't know if you're aware of a British writer called James Herbert. He died last year, sadly. He was huge. He's the, when people talk about the British Stephen King, James Herbert was it. He sold 50-odd million books. He was an absolute hero. He wrote some really trashy but also really excellent books through the 80s and 90s. And I was fortunate enough to be able to interview him when he released his last book a couple of years ago. And we had a good conversation, and he was talking a lot about how he wrote and the process and the kind of things that he wrote about. And it just, after that conversation, I just thought, I need to do something, again, very different. I want to do something immediate, something trashy. And so I describe Strangers as that book. It's a dark and dirty horror novel. There's no pretense to it. It's just a story about a group of outsiders who find themselves transplanted from one environment into the other. And when they get into that other environment, all hell breaks loose. There's a spate of murders, sexually motivated murders, and things get very unpleasant. And of course, all the fingers start pointing at the new arrivals, and the new arrivals start pointing the fingers at everybody else, and then people start pointing fingers at each other, and it gets a bit complicated. And I won't give away the twist, but you know, I often describe it, it's the closest thing that I'll ever get to a vampire novel, even though it's not about vampires as such, but it's kind of got a lot of the themes that you find in vampire books. Very dark and dirty are the best two words to describe it.
It makes me think of like Salem's Lot, where, you know, the guy moves into the old house in the town and nobody knows who he is, and they suspect that he might be doing stuff, and just maybe
that's kind of it. Because one thing that's always struck me, and it was really prevalent in the Hater books, is that everybody, good or bad, however you want to describe them, or however you want to describe yourself, everybody thinks what they're doing is right, and they're doing it for the right reasons. Old Adolf Hitler thought he was great. He didn't think he was this evil supervillain. You know, he genuinely believed in what he was doing. And it's that kind of thing, you know, it's everybody thinking that they're right and distrusting everybody else. And I love to play up on that. Because, you're absolutely right in Salem's Lot, the strange family move in, and it just so happens that it's them that's causing all the trouble, but what if it wasn't? Mm-hmm. What if it was somebody who was already there? Or what if it wasn't anybody at all? I'm going to say too much to give away the book now, so I'll just stop.
Was it a conscious decision for you to move away from the world of the undead, and will you come back to that at some point, you think?
I think when I started writing about zombies, there was myself, David Wellington, and Brian Keane, who are just about the only three people putting zombie books out, I think. But since then, everybody got on the bandwagon. And that's not a bad thing, because it's, you know, the popularity of the Undead has really helped me. It helped me get my work out there. But and I think zombies are also the most adaptable of all horror monsters, because you can put them in any situation. You can say so much about people by looking at zombies. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed all the books that I wrote about them, but I think it was a definite decision to move away and try and do something different. I've just released a little paperback collection of zombie novellas and short stories, and I'm describing that as my final word on the Living Dead for now. There's always a little "for now" in brackets, but because I think it's going to be a long time, but I can't imagine wanting to stay completely away from the Living Dead, because they're too much fun.
It's like the Black Sabbath farewell tour.
Yeah, that's it.
For now.
Yeah. Another Aussie similarity, yeah.
I'm sorry, David. Okay. I can't help myself.
That's all right. Yeah, as long as I don't look like him or sound like him, I'm happy.
Well, you could sing a little bit. Can you sing?
No, we've already established that.
I noticed as a zombie author, too, that, I mean, it is such a crowded genre that it can be difficult to really, you know, challenging to write something that's original these days. I have a little bit of the same feeling. Like, I'm writing a very long zombie series, and I'm sure when I'm done with it, it's going to be something I'm probably going to want to move way away from for a while.
Yeah, I think people, unfortunately, look at zombies, and it happens in film as well as books, and they think it's an easy option, that all we've got to do is tick a few boxes. We have big crowds of zombies, we have plenty of gore, but they kind of miss the point. For me, the best zombie stories are about everything but the zombies. It's just about the characters trying to get through whatever they're trying to get through with this backdrop of the Living Dead. And I think that, the comparison I always use is looking at the differences and similarities between Zombieland and Shaun of the Dead. Zombieland for me is just a kind of slapstick movie. Let's see how many inventive ways we can find to dispatch the dead, whereas Shaun of the Dead is a straight-up story about a group of idiots who just happen to be surrounded by zombies.
Which are both great movies, by the way.
Oh, yeah, both great movies, yeah.
Yeah, I always get a lot of...
Sean.
In my series, some people don't get into it because there's not, like, a zombie on page one. I start, like, before the epidemic. So it's a good, you know, 50, 60 pages before there's even the virus. And I wanted to introduce the characters first and let you see how they are before, so you can kind of, you know what they were like before everything goes down, so that when everything does go down and you see how they have to change, there's more of a progression there, in character development. But a lot of readers, they want zombie killing on the first page, and if you don't give them that, then they just, you know, they put the book down.
Well, I think that's absolutely brilliant. In fact, I actually pitched a TV series once to somebody, with the idea being that it would be a straight-up drama, like no genre influences at all, for about 6 months, and then suddenly the shit would hit the fan. You know, a bomb would go off, the dead would rise or whatever. So people were having to look at these characters that they knew, that they identified with, that they'd been following and investing in for a while, and then watch them trying to deal with something unthinkable. But, of course, nobody's going to make that.
Yeah. But, I mean, I ended up doing it, and it probably was, you know, not a good idea, you know, in terms of selling books, but I wanted to do something different, you know.
Well, it's interesting because, again, I can identify with that from the perspective of writing Autumn, because Autumn seems to be a series that people either really go for or really despise, because I set out to do a few things differently. My only reference point back in the day was really Romero. And I love Romero's first three films. I don't talk about the second three zombie films, but his first three, Night, Dawn, and Day were incredible films, I thought. But there were always little bits of the mythos which really didn't sit well with me, like, why do they eat? Why do they eat? You know, they don't eat brains, I know, in his films, but why do they eat flesh? What's the need to do that? They don't drink, they don't go to the toilet, they don't go to sleep, they don't do anything else, why continue to eat? And I just thought, let's see if I can write a zombie story which does away with all these cliches and tries to do something more believable as a walking corpse could ever be. And I took a heck of a lot of flack for that. Also, because I set the book in the UK, we don't all have guns. In fact, very few people here have guns. So we're not immediately going out with shotguns blasting the dead to pieces. We're having to find different ways to deal with them. And, yeah, I think when you deviate from the norm in a zombie novel, a lot of people appreciate it, but there's a huge number of people as well that think, why isn't this following the normal routine, as you say with your book? Why haven't I got zombies on day one? Why am I having to wait and wade through all this text to get to the gory parts? Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to it than that, I think.
If we're at the saturation point with zombies, or if we're approaching it, do you see the genre sort of deflating back to sort of a standard like vampires? Like, you know, there was a spike in vampire fiction, and that's kind of subsided at post-Twilight, and now it's kind of settled back down. Do you think zombies
will... sparkly vampires?
Yeah, more sparkly, but like, do you think zombie fiction will still continue to be written, but just maybe not at the same volume it is now?
I think it will. I think it's far more... I think zombies themselves are far more adaptable than vampires, for example. I think there's also a lot of similarities between zombies and vampires. In fact, I Am Legend, which people always describe as the first zombie book and the influence for Night of the Living Dead, is really about vampires, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of crossover. And for me, it all boils down to being us versus them. And that's what it is, whether it's apes in Planet of the Apes against humans, whether it's normal zombies, whether it's the infected of 28 Days Later, whatever. It's just a different version of people against normal people against changed people. And I think that's something that will never die. People will never get bored of that because it's what we do all the time. We're always looking for ways that we can differentiate between us and them, between us and everybody else. Mm. So I think that zombies will always be there now. I think that the peak, we've reached the peak, I guess, because they had that sudden huge surge in popularity. And I think it is trailing off, but I can't see it ever going the way that vampires have now and just disappearing right under the radar. I think we're stuck with them. And again, that's great news for zombie authors. Hey, Richard?
Mm-hmm. I hope.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, not just zombie, but like apocalyptic fiction too is, you know, people are so used to sort of feeling secure in their life and the things around them. And then all of a sudden when everything kind of disappears and you don't have that structure anymore to your life and that society there to sort of have your back, you know, how are people going to react? How are they going to change? You know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's what I love about it. I think, as I said earlier, I'm a people watcher. I like watching how people act and react with each other. And to my mind, put them in an apocalyptic situation, and that's probably the only time that you're going to get true reactions, because every decision matters. Every choice they make has a huge implication on whether they live or whether they die, whether their family lives or dies. Whereas at the moment, we have the safety net of society and we can hide behind things. So yeah, I think it's really fascinating. I think pretty much everything I've ever written has an apocalyptic vibe to it just for that reason.
Yeah, it really allows you to be able to explore, you know, characters at a much deeper level than maybe just a more basic thriller or something would allow you to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm kind of curious what type of music you like to listen to.
Ozzy. Black Sabbath, baby.
I don't, actually. I listen to all kinds of stuff. It's not a lot of metal. I know I'm in the minority here in this conversation.
It's okay.
In terms of writing, I just listen to not quite ambient stuff, but instrumental. I can never write to anything with lyrics, so I have this infinite playlist of bands like Mogwai and Nine Inch Nails, particularly Ghosts. I don't know if you know that.
Love Nine Inch Ghosts, Nails album. Yeah.
Yeah, and just lots of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a very eclectic range, but I grew up in the 80s, so I like a lot of really crappy 80s pop as well, I have to say.
I love that stuff.
I did too, and so we'll just promise each other not to talk about it publicly.
It's not that okay. I did like it. I still do like it.
I still do like it.
I love Trent Reznor from Night Snows. I love the soundtrack stuff he does with Atticus, I believe.
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
New one for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo
and Social Network. Yeah, I have both of those albums on repeat a lot of the time when I'm writing. And the best part of Gone Girl, I think, was the soundtrack.
And Ghost was really cool because that was, if I remember correctly, wasn't that one of the first attempts at a major label artist sort of doing it on their own? And there was sort of like a, you had multi-tiers the way you could purchase that. It was a digital download. It was a CD. Yeah. I mean, Reznor's always been out front with that kind of stuff, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and he also gave a large chunk of it away for nothing, didn't he, to try and, to tempt people in. I think, was it the first 10 tracks or something? And then, yeah, you could buy, as you say, download it, buy a CD, buy a gift pack CD, you know, and it was brilliant. And it's just, it didn't hurt the fact that it was a great piece of music, or 30-something great pieces of music.
Yeah, you have to pretty much listen to it all the way through, right? Because if there's a song that you like, oh, damn, which one was that? Because they're all named, like, Ghost 1,
yeah,
30
it.
Or something.
Yeah, my favorite is 17. Oh, no, it's 24. Oh, yeah. The guys are genius. I saw Nine Inch Nails again this year, and they're just phenomenal.
And I'm pretty sure, too, that at least the first 10 tracks, he kind of released those under a Creative Commons attribute license, so you for non-commercial, you could use those, which is so cool. I mean, if you're into the band and then the guy's telling you, like, yeah, you can remix this for fun, like, that's a whole other level of creativity there. It was genius.
And what I love about his music, I think, is the way that you can almost see the way he's put it together, and you can almost deconstruct it, and it's this beat, which you wouldn't think it would fit with this keyboard, but it's brilliant. I also love his stuff with his wife, I think, How to Destroy Angels. That's also really good. Huh. Yeah, it's a kind of side band, but well worth listening to.
Cool. How are we doing on time, Richard?
He's been so active, like, the last 10 years. He went through a period there where he wasn't doing much. And I think, I know he was, you know, he had addiction problems and stuff like that. And it seemed like the minute he got rid of the addiction stuff, he's just been, like, he's coming out with stuff all the time.
Yeah,
we're coming up pretty soon, so we should probably start to wrap up time a little bit.
All right. Well, you know, David, we'll certainly post all the links and info on you in our show notes. For those who might be listening, you know, on the MP3 or in the car or something, you just want to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. My main website is www.davidmoody.net, all one word. But I'm also on Facebook at David Moody Author, and Twitter at David J. Moody. And also Infected Books, www.infectedbooks.co.uk.
Super.
There we go. I think that's all of it.
The new book, Strangers, is coming out on December 1st, and those pre-orders are up right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, and one thing that I do like to mention is that I have a real issue with people buying the same thing twice. I know a lot of bands do that with special versions of albums and deluxe editions and so on and so on, but I only ever want people to buy things once. So if you pre-order Strangers now, you get the ebook downloaded for nothing. And if you buy the ebook and then decide you want the print book, then let me know and you'll get a gift voucher to the amount of the ebook to take off a print version. I think it's only right. People should only buy a book once. So yeah, I'm kind of rambling and not explaining that very well, but check it out on the website because I think it's a good way to do business.
Very cool. Great.
So you said that you have your main website, davidmoody.net, and then you have another site that it's like your sort of indie publisher site. Now, does that just relink to your David Moody?
No.
Is
it's
that like a whole nother site?
It's a whole nother site because I mentioned Infected Books was the publishing house that I started up way, way back to publish the autumn books. But it's kind of always been there and it's growing now. I've started taking on a couple of other authors by invitation and we're looking into other things like Infected Comics and hopefully Infected Films sometime next year. So yeah, it's really it's a brand. Horrible corporate term, but it's a brand and it's working. So we're just going to keep trying to grow it.
Yeah, I have like a brand, like a publisher brand too, but I just have mine like redirect to my main site because I had it for a while where my publisher brand was like my main site, but I thought it really my name should be kind of the thing that I want out there the most.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've done it. I did do it like that for a long time, but now, as I say, we've set up Infected Books as a business running in its own right.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I just want to personally thank you again, David, not only for coming on the show and talking to us, but for being part of the collaboration. It was great to get to know you that way and to finally talk to you post-publication. So sincere gratitude. I appreciate it.
And likewise, thank you for getting me involved, for twisting my arm as you did so very well, and all those emails, and for having me on tonight. It's been great. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, he never asked me to be a part of it.
You should take that personally, Richard.
I do.
All right. Well, that's been it for episode number 18, right, Richard?
18
of the Horror Writers Podcast. If you would be so kind and validate us with a review or a like, we would appreciate it. And once again, thanks for tuning in. This has been the Horror Writers Podcast. Take it easy.
Thanks for tuning in to the Horror Writers Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Do it. Do it now. What are you waiting for? Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter.